hang up the succeeding lecturers for too long by getting started too late. Tuesday, for those of you who are there. Oh, look, I just found a dime. I can get myself a last coat. Tuesday, I talked about secular theology in terms of man and history and showed how the secular theologians were trying to understand redemption in terms of a understanding of creation as really dynamic, provisional, open-ended, rather than a sort of fixed concept of being. And this necessitated a kind of reinterpretation of the whole relationship of God, man, and history to understand creation and redemption in this really open-ended, provisional way, in other words, as really creative, continually creative, rather than a kind of static concept of the world as being and God as a kind of static God who underlines this static world. Today I want to sort of go on with this theme and talk about the church, because it would appear as though the words secular and world and all this were to be opposed to the church. So what does it mean to talk about the church in a secular way? Essentially, I think that the secular theology of the church is an attempt to break down what Bonhoeffer called thinking in terms of two spheres. I was thinking always in terms of a sort of ecclesiastical sphere, which is set over against a non-ecclesiastical sphere, and to be always confined in your theology to these kind of two spheres. To break down this kind of thinking in terms of two spheres and really to see man in the midst of his life as that is the place where God claims him and redeems him and so forth. Now, a part of this problem with breaking down thinking in terms of two spheres is really a cultural problem. That is to say, what we think of as the ecclesiastical sphere is in large part nothing else than an anachronistic society. In other words, it is a sphere which preserves the culture of a past society. It really isn't any more sacred than the culture of our society, but for some reason, you see, the church has become a sphere which preserves the culture of a past society, which is now somehow seen as sacred or godly or churchy or somehow specially related to God, as though God preferred to speak Latin rather than English, or God preferred the motets of the Middle Ages to the jazz of the 20th century or something. You see, I mean, this is nothing else than the culture of a past society preserved and sacralized. And now this culture sets itself against a new culture as though this old culture was in some way specially related to God. And the new culture was not related to God. So part of this this breaking down the thinking in terms of two spheres is really breaking down the sacralism of a past society, which is nothing else but the secular culture of a past society, and to get us back into the midst of the world in which we presently live. So the secular theology of the church, I think, is in large part an effort to sort of get the church out of some kind of old fixed posture of an institution whose culture and whose forms of life were simply formed in terms of a different society and which now stand in an anachronistic relationship to a new society. A new society, which of course arose by negating and bypassing this culture which has become identified with Christian society. So in other words, we have to get into the midst of the world in which we now live simply in order to recover the true tension between church and world, because this tension between 16th century culture and 20th century culture has nothing to do with the tension between church and world. So we have to get into the present world simply in order to recover the true tension between church and world. We have to overcome these kind of inherited cultural boundary marks and stand in the world as it now is. In other words, it's no longer in terms of Roman world empire with its diocese and its center in Rome and all that, which was the culture in which Christianity was originally formed. It's no longer in terms of feudal chivalric society, which medieval forms of the church took on, no longer in terms of the rural life of the farmer, or even the town life of the bourgeois, which was so much shaped the culture of Protestantism. It is no longer in terms of these societies that we have to ask where the church is happening, because these societies are disappearing. But rather it is in terms of our society, in terms of technopolis and metropolis, in terms of the Cold War and the arms race, in terms of developing nations and the Third World. This, you know, in terms of napalm in Vietnam and riots in American cities, this is the world that we have to ask, you know, how it can become redeemed, how it can become the community of the new creation. This is the world in which we live, and where we have to ask how men can overcome alienation and be led into new forms of reconciliation. Now, in the New Testament, the church is defined as the community of the new creation, the community of the new creation. Now, this term new creation suggests, of course, that the church is creation itself, redeemed and made new. In other words, if the church is really creation restored, creation redeemed, then it is not basically some special ecclesiastical world of its own, which is sort of set apart in a sacred society, apart from the life and destiny of creation, but rather the church is really, if you will, the avant-garde of the destiny of creation and human society itself. So secular theology, seems to me, is proposing a new way of testing where the church is. More radical, perhaps, than Luther's test that said the church is where the gospel is rightly preached and the sacraments rightly administered. The term rightly, of course, did not just refer to sort of ritual forms, but where the meaning of this was really understood. It seems to me secular theology is proposing a new way of testing where the church is by saying the church is where this kind of reality of renewal and reconciliation is happening. In other words, the church is wherever God's Spirit is. The church is wherever God's renewing action is taking place in history. And this means that the church is a secular reality. It is happening wherever God's Spirit is stirring the waters of humanity, and groups of men are on the rise to overcome alienating and false modes of existence and being led into new forms of brotherhood. You know, that's where the church is. Now, this presumes, of course, that the Holy Spirit, as the presence of Christ and the power of the new creation, is not, you know, somehow the captive of ecclesiastical ministries. It's not somehow the captive of some kind of channels, ecclesiastical channels and ministries. But the Spirit of Christ, the presence of Christ, is really a free spirit, which is abroad in the land, and whose presence is recognized wherever this kind of thing is happening. In other words, it is recognized wherever alienation is being overcome, wherever this kind of upheaval of judgment and reconciliation is taking place. So here, if you will, is a kind of demythologizing of the ecclesiastical institution and an attempt to understand the real inner reality of this thing and then to point to where that's happening as the place where the church is. Okay. Now, it seems to me that one of the things that's sort of been confusing and which makes it hard for people to understand this kind of thing is that when you dissolve the line between, if you will, the sacred and the secular, when you dissolve the line between the ecclesiastical institution and the non-ecclesiastical institutions, this seems at first to also dissolve the theological line between church and world, which is the line between the sphere of redemption and the sphere of the demonic. And that's why I think people found themselves put off by books like Harvey Cox's secular city, because he seemed to be really doing very little more than throwing off a past ecclesiastical culture in order to embrace some new modern culture as the new creation. And what makes that any more the new creation than the culture of the past, you see? So the dissolving, you know, the throwing off of the ecclesiastical culture seemed to be just getting us into a new way of blessing the modern bonds, as the church of the past had blessed the past bombs. So on. So I think, you know, that as we dissolve the false line, which is the line that suggests that within this ecclesiastical culture we have God, and outside that ecclesiastical culture there isn't any God, as we dissolve that false line, we have to really reassert in a new way the real line between church and world, which is the line between the sphere of the demonic and the sphere of reconciliation, the community of the new creation. But that line, as I hope I can get you to see as I go on, that line is not an institutionalized line. It's not a line that can be institutionalized, but rather it is a constantly shifting line. It's a line that cuts across all of our institutions, ultimately a line that cuts across our own heart, and it's a line where we have to constantly make new judgments about where it is happening. Willy Hertzfeldt proposes the test of where the church is happening by saying that Christ is with the oppressed community. This doesn't mean that the oppressed community are always the holy ones, but simply that if you stand on the side of the oppressed community, you're less likely to go wrong than if you identify with the oppressors. Okay. Now, in order to sort of clear up this confusion, which I think the secular theologians left very unclear, and which therefore gave them the possibility of just being some kind of new sacralism, I think we have to clearly distinguish the theological line between church and world as a line between two different principles of life. St. Paul talks about this as, Augustine talks about this as the sphere of man living for himself, which is the city of man, and the sphere of man living open to God, which is the city of God. So the line between church and world is really a line between two different principles of life. And we have to distinguish this theological distinction between church and world from, you know, from ecclesiastical institution, secular institution. Now let's for a moment just kind of focus on this word secular and sacred, because I think this is also a great source of confusion. If you might say to somebody, what do you think of as secular? And they might say, economics, I mean, that's preeminently secular. Or they might say politics is preeminently secular. But that answer is a very historically conditioned answer, because in fact, those kind of things, economics, politics, and so forth, have in the past been thought of as eminently sacred. For example, in Babylonian society, I would say in early classical societies in general, the economic processes were really seen as the core of the sacred, the whole cycle of the planting and harvesting of land was the cycle around which the sacred festivals were organized. In other words, your whole religious life was really organized around the economic life. And this is where the gods were, and even the land was understood as being owned by the gods. In Babylonia, the land was administered by the priesthood and so forth. So economic processes have in the past been not seen as secular, but as eminently sacred. In a similar way, up until very recently, politics has been seen as eminently sacred, that political sovereignty was derived from God, that the political ruler was the representative of God. He was the vicar of God on earth. Or he was perhaps even God incarnate, which was the Egyptian view, and so forth. So we have a long tradition coming right up to the modern liberal revolutions that overthrew the monarchs by divine right, which saw politics as eminently sacred, and the political leader as really a representative of God and so forth. And I'm not at all sure that the state has by any means entirely given up that idea. I mean, when I saw LBJ being the president of all the people, including all the religions of the people, you had a feeling, you know, that this same linking up of the leader with God was taking place. And we still, you know, want to talk about our government as being under God and so on. So politics has traditionally been seen as a sphere of the sacred. State has by no means entirely given up that idea. Now, what I'm suggesting here is that traditional societies, which would include societies still existing, such as Indian society, don't make this kind of distinction between secular and sacred, but rather the secular processes themselves are seen as sacred in terms of their deeper meaning and import, and you sort of lift up these processes. You lift up the economic process, you lift up the political process, and so forth, in order to point to their deeper meaning, their source, their divine source and deeper meaning. So it's not a sacralism that takes us away from the world, but it is a kind of lifting up of the processes of the world to point to their divine source and their ultimate meaning and so on. Now, it seems to me that in modern society, modern technological society, which has arisen in the Christian West, this sense of the depth and divine grounding of secular processes has been lost. In other words, we no longer think of economics, politics, these things as having some deeper source and meaning. We think of them as self-sufficient and so on. So the loss of this sense of a divine grounding of ordinary social processes has been lost precisely in Christian society. And it has been lost by a process which we call secularization, which is sort of, as it were, cutting off the transcendent source and goal of society and seeing these things as simply self-sufficient. Now, the secular theologians, from Gogarten to Cox and so on, have attributed this process of secularization to Christianity. They said it is Christianity which has secularized the world, and that's why secularization has arisen in the sphere of Christian culture. But this is a very confusing assertion, because it sort of leaves out several rather vital links in the history of secularization. First of all, secularization, to be sure, did arise in Christian culture, but it arises in post-Christian culture. It did not arise when Christianity was new and bright, presumably, in the first couple of centuries, but it arises 17 centuries later, when people are revolting against the sacred society which Christianity itself had created. So it's very confusing to say that Christianity is the source of secularization, when we see that historically it arose only 17 centuries later by way of a revolt of technological forces and rational philosophies, which were revolting against the tutelage of the church. So historically, secularization rose in the West as something which was experienced by the church as a kind of losing rearguard battle, and I think that's the way most Christians still see it, a kind of losing rearguard battle against a rising tide of rebellion that was sort of deposing the church from one sphere of influence after the other, deposing the church from influence over economics, over politics, over education, secularization of education, kicking the church out of education, deposing the church from culture, formation of culture, finally even from the family. all of these were secularized essentially by process of deposing the influence of the ecclesiastical institution and sort of pushing it back step by step. Until finally it appears only in a kind of private sphere. In other words, if you push the church back step by step from all these other spheres, the only sphere that is left is sort of the sphere of the heart, where you are sort of personally related to God. And that's pretty much the way church going appears to a lot of people. In other words, church going is a place where you withdraw from the rest of life. It's a sphere where you kind of turn off your mind. You know, it's lost contact with the intellectual processes that you engage in the rest of the time. You kind of withdraw from the social structures in which you're involved in the rest of the time. And you withdraw into a kind of private sphere where you can be related to God, but the sphere where you are related to God is to a large extent completely unrelated to anything else. And this is what is called church going in modern society. Now, this is a very peculiar idea of the sacred. You know, this kind of private sphere related to God but unrelated to the rest of the world is a very peculiar idea of the sacred, and is really completely different from the idea of the sacred in traditional societies. In other words, in traditional societies, the sacred is not some private sphere related to God but unrelated to the world, but the sacred is really in the midst of the processes of life. It is economics, it's politics, it's sort of the lifting up of the deeper meaning of the ordinary processes of life. So this is what we have inherited as the sphere of the sacred is a very peculiar idea of the sacred, which is not at all the way in which this was understood in traditional societies, including traditional Christian society. Now, this kind of shrinking of the sacred to a kind of privatized institution and the enlarging of the secular sphere to cover the rest of life as a sphere unrelated to God, this is something that appears peculiarly within Christian society in the West, but not as something, which sort of flowed out of a straight line development of Christianity itself by any means. Let's kind of review, if you will, the history of how this peculiar thing happened. First of all, we see the primitive church, which had a very sharp understanding of the distinction between church and world, which it interpreted in an apocalyptic light. Now, what does that mean? That is, it saw itself as a kind of revolutionary new society, which was standing out from a world which was not God's world, but a world ruled by the demonic powers. It talks about the powers and the principalities. So here was a world which is not God's world, a world ruled by the demonic powers. And the church stood out from this as a kind of, as the messianic community of a new world that was to come. A new world that was to come and overthrow the world of the demonic powers and establish the new world of God's kingdom or God's rule. So the church originally understood this tension in an apocalyptic light. You know, it was the messianic society of a new age, and it stood over against a demonic world that was ripe for destruction. Okay, that's the kind of original tension between church and world. Then some very funny thing happened, which Christians have been trying to explain away ever since. Gradually, this church sort of acculturated itself into this same Roman world, which in the book of Revelations was spoken of as, you know, the beast and the Antichrist. It became acculturated in this same society until finally, fourth century with Constantine, it could simply fuse with it and become a new sacred society based on a fusion of Christianity with classicism and Roman world empire. And this was the basis of Christendom. Christendom was based on this coming together of Christianity with classicism and Roman world empire. Now, in modern times, what we have is essentially the displacement or the breaking down of Christendom, the breaking down of this integral Christian society, and in the process, a pushing back of the church from its role as religious sanctioner and guardian of society. Now, the result is that the church, as I suggested, sort of increasingly retreated to a diminishing sphere of influence. It became related to less and less things until finally it appears only in the sort of private relationship of man and God. And yet it still retained its role as the place where man was related to God. The result of this was that man's relation to God itself sort of shrunk until man in sort of his personal feelings was related to God, and everything else was unrelated to God. In other words, the shrinking of the institution back to a diminishing sphere of influence was also understood as a kind of shrinking of the relationship of God to man to a less and less relevant area, if you will. And everything else then, which had deposed the influence of the ecclesiastical institution then as unrelated to God. Now, this is what we call secularization. Now, is this what these people want to celebrate? You know, is that the kind of thing they want to celebrate, this kind of world in which the relationship to God is less and less relevant to man's ordinary life? I think not. And I think that's where the confusion of secular theology has come in, because people assume that that's what they want to celebrate. I think that is not what they want to celebrate. That is really what they want to overcome. In other words, I think secular theology is really an attempt to sort of overcome and undo this process of secularization, if you will. And I think because they haven't completely realized that, they have been rather confused themselves. Now, in the secular theology, you find a distinction between two words which sound very much alike. The one is secularism, and the other is secularity. And those words sound very much alike, and yet in this theology they're actually used as opposites. Secularism is this kind of world unrelated to God, where secularity is really a new way of seeing all of history as related to God. Now, maybe they ought to use words that are not so easily confused with each other. Okay, I think they really want to overcome secularism. They want to dissolve these limiting boundaries of church and religion, which seem to relegate these to some insignificant corner of man's life, and they really want to recover the sense of the gospel as a message about the whole of life. So in a real sense, you might say secular theology might better speak of itself as a new Catholicity, a new effort to see the universality of the gospel related to all men, related to all spheres of life. I'll quote a very nice passage from Bonhoeffer that I think gets this sense of trying to get the realities of the gospel back into the center of life. How do we speak in a secular fashion of God? In what way are we, in a religionless and secular sense, Christians? In what way are we the ecclesia, the church, those who are called forth? Not conceiving of ourselves religiously as specially favored, but as wholly belonging to the world. Then, you know, if we do that, then Christ is no longer an object of religion, in other words, some special cult over on one side, but he is something quite different, indeed and in truth the Lord of the world. I would like to speak of God, not on the borders of life, but at its center, not in weakness, but in strength, not therefore in man's suffering and death, but in his life and prosperity. It is not with the next world that we are concerned, but with this world, as created and preserved and set subject to laws and atoned for and made new. In other words, the new creation is this creation made new. What is above the world is in the gospel intended to exist for the world. In other words, the gospel is not something that takes us away from creation, but something that restores us to creation. So I would say that the secular theologians had a kind of confusing double thing going, because on the one hand, they were kind of fascinated by the modern technological world, and they wanted to affirm it, and yet there was this other aspect of their theology that was really trying to overcome secularism and to see all of life as really related to God. Okay. Now, how do you relate all of life to God how do you relate politics and economics and so on to God without again making these into some kind of sacred society? In other words, how do you avoid that mistake of the past, which sort of sacralizes all the processes of life? How do you avoid that mistake and at the same time really see all of this as related to God? I think that this is where the secular theologians are trying a new interpretation of creation, which can see creation as related to God without sacralizing it. And here, very important, is their effort to overcome the last traces of Platonism and Hellenism. Okay, now what does this mean? Essentially, traditional Christian society took its philosophy, if you will, from Platonism. And they understood God as primordial being and the world as sort of emanating out of God by imitating the divine pattern. Now, what this does is to make God a kind of static being in which, you know, everything is already present, and the world is sort of imitating that pattern. That pattern, which was there from the beginning, and therefore there's nothing really new under the sun. But really, what man is always to do is simply to again and again sort of squeeze himself into the suit which God tailored in the beginning. Now that kind of static concept of God as having already set up the whole pattern, and the world as simply a imitation of the divine pattern, creates in effect a static society and a static creation. Creation is not an ongoing process, and society is not an ongoing process. But what happens is that all the orders of creation and all the orders of society now become fixed. You know, it would become a blasphemy against God to change any of the orders of society or creation, because these are divine in their roots. Now, what these guys are saying is we have to overthrow that kind of Hellenistic idea of God in the world, and we have to get to a really biblical idea of creation. And the really biblical idea of creation is that God is radically transcendent. Therefore, he is not to be seen as existing in a closed metaphysical system with the world. And the world is really open-ended and free. It is a contingent reality, which means it's open-ended and free. It's finite. And that means everything is not fixed from the beginning, but the creative process goes on. And this means that the world is really historical. And that's what the word secular means. It means that the world is really historical. There are constantly new things happening which were not there before. The world is really historical. New things happen. So it's the secular theology, if you will, is really a kind of new understanding of creation and the relationship of creation to God. That God is transcendent, and the world is historical. Open-ended, it is finite, it is free, it is provisional. That is to say, the society that you found now is not the final society. It is just a provisional society which must be continually remade for new times. In other words, you're incorporating a real sense of change into the sense of creation. And this is what classical society didn't have at all. They had no sense of the historical dimension of creation. So from this perspective, we can say that secular theology is really a new emphasis on the doctrine of creation, an attempt to get rid of Hellenism and to really understand the proper relationship of man and God in the created relationship, and therefore to understand the world as related to God without making the world sacred and enclosed and static. See what I mean? Okay, now the doctrine of creation is a great doctrine, to be sure, but there are other doctrines, such as the fall and redemption. What does secular theology do with those? If we are really to sort of go on with this picture, we have to relate this doctrine of creation to that of redemption. Okay. The gospel says that this man who was created free, free to be historical, free to be really a created being, is also free to be irresponsible. He can surrender his freedom to the works of his own hands and so fall into alienation, to fall into a false and demonic mode of existence. And it's in this situation that God acts not merely as creator but as redeemer, as the redeemer of creation, rescuing man from this demonic, alienated form of existence and restoring him to responsible freedom. Now, how does this fall of creation come about? For the secular theologians, it comes about precisely because man tries to be like God. In other words, man is not content to really be this free, created creature. He doesn't want to live in the created relationship, but he wants to be like God, which is to say, he wants to make his own works sacred. In other words, the whole rising of sacred societies is an intimate part of the fall of man. He wants to abolish the created status of being and substitute a self-deification of the works of his own hands. He wants to abolish history, get rid of history, get rid of change, and create something which is just permanent and sacred and can stay there forever. In other words, he wants to sort of imitate the permanence of God by pretending that his own institutions can be permanent. And so sacred societies are really an expression of the fall of man. And these sacred societies then are what the New Testament speaks of as the sphere of the powers and principalities, the rule of the demonic, and so on. Now, let's get on to this word world. I think the problem with the word world, as over against church, is that we confuse the word world with the word nature. In other words, when we say this world, we think of just, you know, ordinary life and the hills and the trees and the streets and so forth. We think of ordinary nature and ordinary man. In other words, we kind of confuse the word world with the word nature or creation or something like that. Now, in the New Testament, the word world is not synonymous with the word creation, but it's really the opposite, you might say. It's really the opposite of the word creation. When the Gospel of John talks about this world and the prince of this world, he's not talking about the world that God created, but he's talking about this fallen demonic world which is ruled by the powers and the principalities and so forth. He's talking about this sphere which has fallen under the servitude of man's idolatry, which is given over to an oppressive relationship between man and man. And this is the theological identity of what's called this world, worldliness and so forth. Now, it is not the world that God created, but the world which man created, if you will. Now, it seems to me that this whole sort of hang-up of differentiating church and world comes about because we identify the word world with nature, and so when we say you must leave the world, you think that people ought to somehow take leave from their bodies and ordinary life and so forth. And this is not, I think, what the New Testament means at all. This world is the sphere of the demonic. It is creation fallen under the servitude of idols, whereas the church is simply that sphere where this world is being overcome. It is creation redeemed and made new. And this means that redemption is not something that takes us away from creation, but it is really something that restores us to creation. And this means, of course, that redemption really restores us to created existence. It restores us to a historical, secular, restores us to historical, secular, that is to say, provisional existence. Existence which doesn't try to enclose itself in static sacred orders, but which is really open to change, open to constant new possibilities, because that's the way you live as a created being. Because you're not God, you are the created being. So Redemption is also a restoration to real historical existence from this kind of effort to fix everything once and for all. Okay, now what I'm trying to get at with all of this is that the concepts church and world are really theological words for the sphere of the demonic, the sphere of the oppressive, over against the sphere of reconciliation. They stand for two principles of life, and therefore they cannot be institutionalized. They cannot be identified with ecclesiastical institution, non-ecclesiastical institution. As I said to Willie, the last trick of the devil is to try to take the true judgment between where Jesus is and where the oppressor is, to try to take that true judgment and institutionalize it, and therefore set up some kind of structures which will then, you know, once and for all tell you where the good guys are. And that's not possible, because the place where these two principles of life are being lived is constantly changing. And perhaps in the 19th century, the oppressed people might be the working class, but in the 20th century, the working class might become the oppressors, as I think they have in unionized labor and so on. So you can't always, when you institutionalize labor and say that's where the good guys are, then you get a demonic kind of thing. You can't institutionalize that. You have to constantly remake the judgment of where the demonic is, where the sphere of reconciliation might be happening, and so on. So these two spheres of church and world point to theological principles of existence. They cannot be institutionalized. They cannot be identified with ecclesiastical institution, non-ecclesiastical institution, but really they cut across all institutions. They cut across not only the secular world, but they cut across the ecclesiastical institution as well. And this is, of course, what the Reformation meant when they said that the Church of Rome was the church of the Antichrist. They were not talking about somebody else's church, you know. They were talking about their own church. So if you continue that kind of language, you don't continue it by talking about somebody else's church, but by talking about your own. So when they said the Church of Rome is the church of the Antichrist, they were talking about their own church, and they were reflecting the horrified discovery of late medieval man that the ecclesiastical institution is in no way exempt from sin, but it can become indeed one of the principal exponents of that evil principle of life which the gospel calls the domain of the Antichrist, and which of course the gospel comes to overthrow. And this means that the gospel can become a power to overthrow the gods of the church, not simply to overthrow the gods of secular society, but the gospel can also become a power to overthrow the church, if you will, to overthrow the ecclesiastical institution and proclaim the death of its gods. So these two spheres cut across institutions, and they judge all institutions, including the church. This means that the institutional church does not monopolize the reality of redemption. It is not, quote, the Catholic Church, and that means all of these institutions put together. It is not the Catholic Church because this includes all of mankind and all of history by intentionality. In other words, God intends to redeem all men. The role of the institutional church, seems to me, is to show forth as best it can a kind of paradigm of what the reconciled society should be like, and to act as a servant of the whole church of mankind, if you will. The historical church has a kind of special self-consciousness as a bearer of this message. In other words, it bears this message, it reflects upon it and interprets it, but from the point of view of where this redemption is happening, it doesn't monopolize it. You know, it bears this message, but this message is not just about itself, but about mankind. And from the point of view of where redemption is really happening, the ecclesiastical institution has no special rights or priorities. The message is not exclusively about itself, but it is about mankind. The mission does not exclusively emanate from itself, but rather it is God who promulgates the mission. The mission is already abroad in the land. And it is the job of the church to join God's mission, you know, to find where this mission is happening and join it, rather than to think that somehow it monopolizes the promulgation of God's mission. The mission is bigger than we are. And the best we can do I mean, the very best we can do is to really be a part of it rather than not a part of it. Now, part of the problem, of course, is these very walls, these very cultural barriers that define ecclesiastical institution, non-ecclesiastical institution, sort of mess up our minds, and they keep on messing up our minds. And it makes it very hard to see the real truth here. And that's why I think we have to kind of break down the walls of these two spheres. We have to kind of overrun the boundaries both ways, if you will. You have to let the church be a place where all kinds of things can happen, where people who don't have any kind of ecclesiastical banners, you know, flying over their works can come in and just find the church a place that they can use. So the church has to sort of be overrun, if you will, by people who find the church just a open place, which they can use without, you know, somehow signing some pledge of allegiance or something like that. And I think that the realities of the church have to sort of overrun in the other direction. So preaching and celebrating and forgiving and all of these realities cease to be kind of special little rituals that go on in the church and really come to be seen as the essence of how man lives day to day. So I think we have to kind of overrun these boundaries. And I think some of that is really happening in the new church renewal, that there is an effort to kind of overrun the boundaries, to simply make the church buildings a open place that people can use without signing up on the church rolls, and sort of to overrun the realities of the church in the other direction and get people to see celebrating and forgiving and preaching and so on as the reality of man's day-to-day life. Okay.
So, you think it's possible to accomplish this, which I mean, I firmly believe this, but do you think it's possible to accomplish this through the denominational structure, the vice that they give? I mean, it seems to me that this is, you know, impossible underneath the current institutionalized structure of church.
Well, the difficulty, if not impossibility, is seen by the fact that virtually every minister that tries to live this way gets driven out of the institution.
Right.
And this is true of Protestants as well as Catholics.
You
get this kind of thing even from people who come to Holden and who have found liturgy, let's say, as something that's not just a ritual, but something that really is about them and their life. And once they've experienced this, you know, that they get into a kind of frustration with their church institution. And again, people leaving here have said something like, I just can't stand to go back to my church.
So, right.
In other words, you precisely by seeing how this thing ought to be lived as a real, you know, as a real, not just human, but God-man-human relationship in the midst of life, precisely by seeing this, you know, you increase your sense of alienation from the institution, because you know it becomes so apparent that they have ritualized this and really made it demonic, really.
Again, you're saying, and I'm hearing, and my interpretation is this is almost a case for a further denominalization, because to reconstruct what I think you said was in the beginning, the apostles, and shortly thereafter was the true church. I didn't have too much time to stray, and then. To personalize, along came the Catholic Church, and it had its turn in the barrel, so to speak, in ruling the world as it was known. And the church was all powerful, and it did have the sacred and the outside world brought into one. But let's say it failed. Luther came along, and he rebelled against the very thing that you're talking about, and tried to enlighten the world by changing the road that the Catholic Church was going. And since that time, you know, we've had the medieval history in England and so on, where the prince and the king and were church and state and everything, and with all the inequities, you know, that everything then going on through then to our present day, with the many denominations that we have, each proclaiming that, you know, they're the way. You are now saying that all of the denominations are virtually wrong. They're, you know, they're institutionalized, and that the sacred theology and the outside world are like two different worlds when they should be one in the right interpretation, what I'm getting at is the right interpretation. Each one of these, from the Catholic Church to Martin Luther to the various church states to the Methodist, the Baptist, and so on, each of them are saying that they're right. And you're saying you have to look for the one that's right. And you're talking about now a new interpretation of the sacred theology that overcomes all these wrongs of the race problems, the war, and everything. And what is that new denomination that's going to give it the right interpretation? And who's going to give it that right interpretation? Winter, Adolf, Gottwald, Luther, let me maybe end my statement saying that we now have a whole mess of denominations, from the Lutherans to the Catholics, Methodists, so on, to the Jehovah's Witnesses, Seventh-day Adventists, and Mormons. Now, we have that, and I think we generally know what they are. Which one of these come the closest? Now, wait a minute. We're talking a spread now between a new right way and the wrong way. And we have all these denominations. Which of these come the closest to what you have been saying is the right way? I'm not saying which is the. Which is the closest?
I would say that the source of all the wrong ways is asking that question. You see, in other words, the source of all the wrong ways is to try to find an institution. The source of all the wrong ways is to find an institution which is the right way. In other words, to try to institutionalize the sphere of God's relation to man, which you can't institutionalize, but which is which is to be lived across the thing. Now, Christendom was the effort to get God's relationship to man together in one sphere, really. But they did it in a sacralizing way. And the Reformation by no means overthrew that, but in fact continued it. In other words, Luther as much, and Calvin as much as the medieval church, insisted on the unity of church and state, the relationship of the church to the magistrates. That's why the Lutheran and Calvinistic Reformation are called the Magisterial Reformation, over against the left wing that rejected the relationship of church and state. So the Reformation, the mainstream Reformation, did not overthrow Christendom, but rather continued it in a national way. In other words, the Christendom broke down into Christian nation states and so forth. And really, the overthrow of this comes not with the Reformation, but with the Enlightenment, rationalism, and finally the liberal revolutions, which overthrew sacred society, but then substituted that for a new society unrelated to God. Now, what these people are trying to do is get back into a biblical relationship of God and man, which really judges man wherever he is, relates man to God wherever he is, without sort of making those places sacred and static, and holy and unchangeable and infallible and immutable, etc. You see, so that means that all of these denominations are not necessarily any of them any more wrong than the others, because any one of them can be a sphere which now overthrows its false self understanding and puts itself back as just a humble servant of God. Any one of them can be that place. Now, how we overcome this inherited plurality is another question. I'm not terribly excited about the idea of getting all these church institutions together in a giant corporation merger, because that doesn't seem to me to have anything to do with solving the problem, but really to get a new self-understanding of
how. The conclusion that I draw from this then, and that is that after this first generation of the right church, the total death of the teachings of Christ, for this reason, that you and we will see this right way, and we do not institutionalize it, but you see it, and let's say in this abstract, God acknowledges that it's the right way, and I see it the right way. Our thoughts are common, and through just being human, we age and we pass away. In the interim, we have created children. We have given birth to children.
Yeah.
They, now being human, grow, and they're the creatures of their experiences. If we don't pass on to them in some form that which we know is right, they don't pick it up, then right there is the end. When our generation goes, that is the end then of the whole thing that we were seeking, because it's not institutionalized. There's no organized way to pass it on. Because if we were to let children grow up to their own devices and to find their own way, maybe in that next generation only one or two might find that right way instead of, you know, the two of us or this whole room full of people. And if you don't institutionalize in some form, Rosemary, I conclude that Christianity, this Christianity which you are proposing and which we found, will die.
No, see, we're not rejecting institutions at all. Christianity has a problem with history. There's no doubt about that. And part of the original apocalyptic view was really based on the notion that there wouldn't be any future history. You see, that you didn't really have to get married because you were the first generation of the new world, and there wasn't going to be any future history. You see, in other words, that was a mistake. but that was a part of the original apocalyptic view, which obviously had a problem with history. Now, the part of the difficulty was facing up to the truth, which namely that history was going to go on and the world wasn't going to come to an end in that literal way that the church thought. Now, if the church had not come to terms with that fact, it would have become a Jehovah Witness sect, you see. In other words, it was responding to truth by recognizing that its original apocalyptic thing was too limited, that it had a mythological notion of the end of the world as, you know, literally the end of history. So it was responding to true, to a encounter with new truth when it made that turn from the early apocalyptic church, you know, to what's sometimes called the Catholic Church. The problem then, I think, is not institutions, but really to understand institutions as historical, you see, and not to sort of fuse your institutions with God in such a way that they become sort of immutable institutions, but really to relativize institutions and understand them as you must understand man himself, as really created, and therefore having to live by constantly responding to new demands rather than sort of setting up something which is sacred now and forever. You see, now after all, we have plenty of institutions which are able to live that way. I mean, I think that education, universities and so forth are certainly, you know, fairly well-developed structures, but they have structures which have learned to live historically. So we're basically asking, you know, for man to live historically, and he's learned to now to have most of his institutions live historically, and the one institution which is still sort of, you know, hasn't quite learned this lesson is the church, because it's still sort of tied in with an earlier sacral society.
Does he mean living historically that you in a sense reject some of the cultural patterns of the past? Is it possible to live historically and say celebrate a Gregorian chant or
right? Yeah,
by
right.
Thinking of it in its perspective.
Sure. Now this is another thing which I think that a real historical existence would really restore to us. In other words, I think we could really make quite a difference between a sense of the tradition, which is really historical, and traditionalism. Now, traditionalism really is a way of trying to blank out history and set up a tradition as immutable, you see, and so it's unchangeable. And so you really cannot even relate to that as a culture in its own historical milieu, because it becomes a kind of a perennial culture which has no historical framework. And this is the way, let's say, Catholicism dealt with Thomas Aquinas. They couldn't deal with Thomas Aquinas as simply, you know, relative to his culture. They had to make him sort of historyless, eternal philosopher, you see. So I think that a sense of living historically, which breaks this traditionalism, which is immutable and which is the only culture that's possible, really restores us to an ability to kind of move around in the rooms of our house in the past and have them in a way that doesn't enslave us to them.
I can really vibrate to that, and it seems that would open us up for enriching experiences. A God said yes, yes, yes.
Yeah. Right, right,
Bach,
right.
Cantata. I think there are some people that feel that this new spirit, you know, throws everything out.
Yeah. Now the interesting thing.
I think judgment means abolition instead of renewal.
Yeah.
And this sort of frees people to celebrate within the frame of reference of.
Yeah, you can really recover your history.
Yeah,
you can really recover your history in its proper relation to history. Rather, whereas this other thing, I think, tends to enslave you to the past, and therefore make it impossible for you to really have that past in a real historical way. And I think an interesting example of this is the way in which the Reformation initially had to sort of lose its medieval past. You see, I mean, all of that was you know, Antichrist and so forth, and so one had to almost repudiate any of that as being any good, really lose your past, which was, after all, their past, to kind of lose the medieval past in order to get something new. Now, I think what's happening now is that we're now becoming free enough that you can get people like Heiko Obermann and so forth, who's a Calvinist and a late medieval scholar, and really recover that past in its own relative framework, you know, as having some true words to say about the gospel, whereas this other thing gets you into the most unhistorical kind of stuff, in which you say you had the true church in the first century, and then black, it disappeared. There was, you know, we had no true gospel for about, 20 centuries from Jesus up till Harvey Cox or something. you know, you get a complete blank of continuity.
I
see what I mean?
There should be some correlation between cultural.
And frankly, I don't think that early church was any holier than we are.
Yeah.
You know,
somehow,
I mean, if you,
everyone got saw the light in the next 25 years. What would you, or 100 years? What would you see as the ideal situation? If you have time, how would you like to make a guess at what would be?
Yeah, I think the problem is very severe because institutions, by their very nature, are committed to self-perpetuation. In other words, they resist historical existence. They resist self-criticism. That's just a part of the fallenness of man. And so they tend to self-perpetuation, and this becomes particularly acute with the church because its calling is to really die and to continually give itself up and so forth. And so it really runs head-on to this other impulse towards self-perpetuation, and you get constantly this business of saying, well, we can't lose the gospel we can't preach the gospel because we will lose the pillars of the church and we won't get any money, you see. In other words, the perpetuation of the institution just runs head-on again and again with the gospel, and you again and again say you can't preach the gospel here because it will threaten our bank account, and this happens at Holden Village, among other places.